These jumbled about and came to rest on the inner walls of the mountain. Again, there was a shudder. They felt pressure in their ears. It could only mean one thing. "He's doing it!" Rodario whooped, still holding his injured side. "He's actually doing it! That's what I call a proper test for a new Magus!" He sat down again. "And when he's finished saving our lives, can he please sort out this wound for me if I've passed out?" he added through clenched teeth. "Keep watching the walls!" Tungdil shouted, reminding them of the presence of the Alf. "Why are we doing it the favor of saving its life too?" grumbled Ironheart. "Don't let it get away when we get up top." He was deliberately sounding certain of success. But the water had reached their thighs and had filled their boots. They could only hope that Durgard was going to pass his test and save them all. And as the water level started to sink, there seemed no doubt that he was succeeding. "Let's get down and out. Who knows how long Durgard can hold the island?" exclaimed Tungdil. "Look for something we can use as a boat." They hurried off the platform and ran back all the way to the cave, past ruined forges and the corpses of dwarves, soldiers and workers, over great lumps of rubble still radiating incredible heat. In the grotto, they found some longboats tied up in a niche. Rodario remembered seeing guards rowing them, disguised as Alfar. Outside, it was dark. Night had fallen. Elria spared them the trial of a new storm and let the stars shine down. They ran out onto the foreshore and launched the boats. "Anyone seen that Alf?" asked Tungdil, looking around. "No idea where it's got to. But it'll go down with the island, I hope," said Ironheart. "Though I'd have preferred to split it down the middle." Durgard, sitting in Tungdil's boat, suddenly collapsed wordlessly. The strain had been too much for him to bear. For a Magus with absolutely no experience, he had achieved miracles. But the island did not submerge. So long as the chambers were not flooded, it would float on the waves like a cork refusing to sink. "We must repair the mechanism," said Tungdil. "We'll need it again. Durgard will have to recharge." "Without Fergus?" Rodario's boat came alongside. "How can we do that?" Tungdil struggled with himself. Should he tell them what Veltaga had said? It was all lies, wasn't it? On the other hand, even if some of it were true, it made no difference now. Fergus and the Thirdlings were dead. There was no danger of new machines. Thus far, everyone thought Bandalore and Veltaga were the evil masterminds. He decided that was the way it should stay. "We'll manage somehow," he told Rodario. "We don't have to do it all quite as perfectly as he did it. We just have to be able to get down to the magic source and back up again. Perhaps force fields will form, extending as far as dry land. But until then, Durgard will have to go diving from time to time." On his left, he saw some lights and a dark silhouette. "There's an island with people on it. We'll row over there and then return with one of Queen Wei's ships. The soldiers can guard our conquest. We've got to get to Taboribor, or wherever the unslayables are now." There were no objections. They rowed over to the island, found a little fishing harbour, and asked their way to the village leader, who they hoped might be able to provide them with soldiers. A fisherman took them to the brightly lit house of the village elder. "Come in." He greeted them still in his nightshirt, his brown hair tousled. "It's a quiet night, it seems."
"What do you mean?" asked Ironheart.
"You're not the first to visit me." He invited them into his official chamber and showed them the other visitor. Wrapped in blankets in front of the stove, drying his wet hair and warming himself. Tungdil knew the figure immediately, from his grey beard, white hair, and the light blue eyes staring straight at him. Faced by the familiar, friendly smile of one he thought he'd lost forever, he was completely overcome. He ran and embraced him.
"Lot,
Ionan! He sobbed with joy. Girdlegard, Kingdom of Eidoslain, former Orc realm of Toboribor, summer 6241st solar cycle. The Unslayable One stood in the shadows at the mouth of the cave. In his left hand he held a curved longbow. In front of him 10 wire-reinforced arrows stuck upright in the rotting corpse of an overbold soldier, killed 11 orbits previously. So far no further warriors had shown themselves.
I can smell you.
30 soldiers. 24 men, 6 women. They were crouching behind a rock, trying to work out how they could make it into the cave without incurring loss of life. These were scouts, sent out while the army was limiting its action to throwing a cordon around the hill.
As if you could fence me in.
Every now and again, small units would try to get inside Toboribor. In vain. No one was getting past him and the bastards. The Unslayable One was angry. Getting the diamond had taken much longer than he had thought. He was becoming uneasy. It was delaying their departure and prolonging the danger for his beloved sister. He was not stupid enough to think the human army would hang around forever. And if what the bastards on their travels had told him was true, strange things were happening involving the petrified statue of the old Magus, Lot Ionan. He had not reckoned with that. 3 intrepid scouts were making their way up the hill, dodging from rock to rock, their paths intersecting.
You shall die together, he mouthed.
Pulling a black arrow out of the cadaver, he notched it and drew back the string. Just before the paths of the 3 scouts crossed again, he sent the arrow to its target. It hit the first through the throat, killing the man behind and piercing the right eye of the smaller female soldier bringing up the rear. Her shrill scream brought a smile to his lips. She fell backwards and crawled to the shelter of the nearest rock. None of the support troop dared come to her aid. It was clear death was waiting in ambush. The Unslayable One lowered his longbow and waited, watching the banners on the tents in the distance.
To think so many humans are needed to vanquish a handful of enemies, he thought contemptuously. How weak they are. They've always needed the help of others.
He saw 2 soldiers trying to reach the injured female. They will all be destroyed sooner or later. He picked out the next arrow, blew on the damp tip to dry off the decaying moist flesh from the corpse, and prepared his next shot.
What a shame I shan't see it. I'll come back in 100 cycles to see what has happened to the land.
The 2 warriors were trying hard not to be observed. They nearly managed it, but when the Unslayable took 1 step to the side, he saw them. They were supporting the injured girl between them and helping her along. Exactly the right configuration to ensure they all died at once. He ran out of the cave mouth, leaping onto a rock to achieve the height needed for a diagonal aim. He spanned the bow and loosed the feathered end of the arrow.
Fly and take their souls.
The arrow hummed through the air like black lightning, pinning the legs of all 3 soldiers. They fell, stapled together by the arrow's shaft, and screaming in pain. Music to the ears of the Unslayable One. This masterful shot wakened the courage of the others.
There he is!
He heard the angry shout of a woman and glimpsed the top of her helmet over the rock she was sheltering behind.
Quick! He's on his own, and he can't get all of us! Or do we let him go on killing?
She stormed out toward him, her shield held high and sword drawn. The other 24 warriors followed her with whoops to give themselves courage. He dropped the bow, unhurriedly drew out both swords, and waited for them to attack. This was just what he needed. Fresh blood to finish the next part of the ceremonial painting he had undertaken in order to welcome Nagsar Inaste back to life.
He did not have the herbs from John Balsur that kept the tints fluid, so he had to keep getting new paint. He did not move until their first wave was less than 3 paces away. Then, swiveling elegantly to avoid 2 arrows flying at him from a distance, he launched himself into his attacker's midst. Humans moved more swiftly and flexibly in battle than dull orcs, but it still did not make them opponents to fear. Not these ones, anyway. The unslayable one strode through them, distributing precise, death-dealing blows left and right, so the men floundered and obstructed each other. His 2 swords admirably delivered their fatal blows. Blood coated the blades and flew off, splattering the rocks, making patterns and lines on the black and grey. The incidental artwork delighted him. Swinging his arms faster still, he savoured the creation of this spontaneous fresco. He dealt with the human attackers as if it were a routine execution. So superior was his strength that his slaughter could not be described as a battle. Mangled corpses and severed limbs lay all around, and death cries provided a chorus audible to the waiting army. Back at base, there was uproar as a cavalry unit rode off to the aid of the scouts. The drumming of approaching hoofbeats did not disturb the unslayable one. He faced the lone swordswoman who had egged the others on. The tip of his sword was directed at her quivering body as she lowered her own weapon. He read the horror in her green eyes. "The name of your death is Nagsor Inaste," he addressed her, knowing she would not understand. The sound of his voice was enough to make her drop the shield and sword she bore. "I shall kill your body and soul, so that nothing can remain of you." He stabbed her through the throat, and she convulsed, clutching at the blade as if to postpone her end. "Expire, mortal." Drawing the blade downwards, he sliced through her breast and belly. She fell with a sigh. He grasped her helmet, and, bending swiftly, used it to catch the dark blood spurting warm out of her neck. It would enable him to finish another swathe of the painting. As he stood up, he saw the riders approaching. There was no time for another fight now, or his paint would clot. Down in his quarters, a blood-encrusted diamond lay on the table, and next to it the decomposing severed forearm of a groundling. The golden bracelet on it showed the high status of its owner. He must have been holding the diamond when one of the bastards caught up with him. "By Samusin and Tion." The unslayable put the helmet on the table, picked up the diamond, and rubbed the crumbling bits of dried blood off. "He's done it. He's brought me the diamond." It was of no consequence to him who had found the stone. There would be no words of praise. The bastards did not recognize any emotions other than contempt and hatred. They felt no pity in the face of pain caused by the machines. They existed for one purpose only, to obtain the diamond for Nagsor Inaste. He had even forbidden them to speak to him. The sound of their voices made him mad. His right fist closed round the stone. "As soon as she opens her eyes, the bastard shall die. Either I shall pitch them against the machines to cover our flight, or I will finish them off with my own hands." The unslayable one hastened out, traversing the corridors until he came to the cavern where he had placed his sister. He ran up the steps to where she lay, pulling his helmet off from his black hair. "Look what I've brought you," he said lovingly as he knelt at her side. "This will make you better." Expectantly, he placed the diamond between her folded hands and intoned the formula he had rehearsed in his mind all through the battle. Every syllable was enunciated with care. The rise and fall of the incantation followed exactly the instructions he had found in the old books. Nothing happened. "Blasted E-oil! What has she done to it?" He took the diamond in the tips of his fingers. "Obey me!" he told it.
I know the spell that makes your light subject to me. The parchment rolls in John revealed your secret to me. You cannot resist.
He brought the stone up to eye level and repeated the dark incantation. Inside the artifact, a reluctant glimmer appeared. The facets refracted the cavern's dull light and threw a pattern onto the walls, the ceiling, his own features, and those of Nagsar Inaste.
My God, he whispered, bending over her. How beautiful you are, my beloved sister.
He laid the stone back in her hands and touched her on the shoulder.
Awake from your sleep.
She did not move.
Nagsar Inaste, rise up,
he beseeched, placing his face close to hers. Her breast rose and fell imperceptibly. Warm air streamed gently out of her nostrils, but she remained as if dead. The unslayable one stared at the stone.
You need more time? Is that it?
A spark of light ran over his sister's body, played on the altar, and zoomed back into the diamond.
Then time you shall have, he promised darkly, standing up and replacing the helmet over his headcloth.
He walked backwards down the steps, turned away from his sibling, and returned to the cave where he had killed the soldiers. This delay would give him time to complete the painting. The diamond would carry out its healing work, he hoped. Somehow he would unlock its power for himself.
Out of light, I shall create darkness.
There would soon be no more elves in Girdlegard. If need be, the Battle of Toborabor can run for another 100 cycles.
This is just the blink of an eye for me.
Back at the cave entrance, he saw that 10 of the cavalry riders were busy loading the dead onto a wagon not 40 paces away. Their horses waited impatiently, tethered to a rock.
How thoughtful of the humans!
The unslayable one took his bow and moved over to the rotting cadaver, which still held 8 arrows ready for him. The woman fighter's blood would have coagulated by now. Time to collect fresh supplies. His black gaze fastened on 2 men lifting a fallen comrade by the arms and legs. As soon as they straightened up, they were in line, one behind the other.
2 at 1 shot.
He pulled an arrow from the corpse and notched it slowly. Girdlegard, Queendom of Wayern, 12 miles northwest of Mithridania, late summer, 6241st solar cycle. Tungdil's delight at being able to embrace his long-lost foster father, something he would never have dared to do as his young apprentice, was difficult to express in words.
You are come alive again, resurrected from the stones, venerable Lot Ionan. The gods were with us all, he rejoiced.
Lot Ionan smiled at him, the wrinkled face transformed.
Tungdil Bolofar, a familiar face amongst the strangers in Wayern. You have grown strong, strong and earnest, like a warrior now. Not my young smith and errand boy.
He looked round at the others by the door. He knew none of them.
I assume there's lots to tell. I have heard that Nudin was destroyed. More than 6 or 7 cycles passed. Aren't you too tired? Not in the slightest. It's as if I've bathed in the fountain of eternal youth.
What is the last thing you remember? The Magus reflected.
It was the dispute with Nudin. I thought sand was running through my veins, and my heart was turning to stone, dying. The next moment, I awoke on the bottom of a lake, and drowning. My magic saved me.
We know there is a new magic source there, honored sir, said Tungdil. But the other source has dried up forever. Before continuing, he turned to his companions. It's best you go and rest now. Get your wounds attended to. On the morrow, we shall all leave for Toborabor. I have a lot to talk about with my foster father here, Lot Ionan.
I need to tell him what has been happening in Girdlegard. Then he looked at the village spokesman. Be good enough to see we have somewhere to sleep. Queen Wei will reimburse you for the expense. Please bring us refreshment.
Of course, replied the man, getting up to give the relevant instructions.
A little later, they were brought cheese, dried fish, bread and wine. Tungdil smelled the wine, but resisted the temptation. He shook Lot Ionan's hand once more.
I am so glad to see you, he repeated, drawing up a chair next to him.
The Magus noticed the golden mark on Tungdil's hand as it shimmered in the firelight.
What's this then?
The eyes observed him sharply.
What is happening in Girdlegard?
Running his hands over Tungdil's short brown hair, he said,
And most of all, I want to know how things have been for you.
Tungdil suppressed his weariness and related stories from the old times. Battles with Nudin, and against the Eoil and her avatars. He told the Magus she was an elf who had brought disaster to the land. He kept it short, telling only the bare facts. But time sped by, and when dawn showed rosy red on the horizon, he was just coming to the most recent events. He told his foster father about the diamonds, the thirdlings, and the unslayable siblings.
Now they have got the diamond. They will try to use its power for evil. At the same time, a huge army threatens the Fourthling's Gate. It is made up of undergroundlings, orcs, and others. They are the original owners of the diamond, and have the right to demand its return.
He finished his report.
You have come back at the very best moment.
He yawned, not able to resist the urge any longer. Lot Ionan was silent, and stared at the flames in the fireplace. His hair and his beard were dry by now, and he looked as if he had never been turned to stone.
The friends of yore are all dead. Nothing is as I knew it.
His light blue eyes looked out of the window.
Hardly am I free from Nodurn's curse, still trying to take in all the news, and already I must prepare to meet the next mighty foe.
He sighed.
And my Tungdil Bolofar is now Tungdil Goldhand, a proper dwarf. A hero.
He shook his white head.
Ye gods! What have you done to my world?
Your vaults are still there, smiled Tungdil. The orcs did not destroy everything when they raged through.
A little stability in these new times.
Lot Ionan turned and put his hand on Tungdil's shoulder.
But if Palandiel, and apparently Samusin as well, want me and the young Magus to save Girdlegard from the Unslayables? Then so be it. You made your real father more than proud, and I am so proud of you too.
Tungdil's eyes were swimming with emotion.
What shall we do, venerable sir? What you suggested? I will see the elf waiting on Windsport Island and hear what he has to say. It is hard to believe that the elves have left the path of light and been dazzled by the forces of evil.
He reached for some of the cheese. As he did so, he took a sharp intake of breath and stood up, clutching his back.
Revered Lot Ionan, what?
He raised his hand.
It's nothing, Tungdil. It seems not all of me is yet free of the petrifying curse.
He made another attempt to reach out for the cheese, and this time managed it.
It might be old age, he smiled. I like to forget how many cycles I have lived so far. I'm not counting my statue time.
He ate the cheese and drank some wine.
Then we'll be off to Toporibor to see about the Unslayables. On the way, I'll test Durgard a bit, so that I can evaluate his talent. We should be able to vanquish the Alfar leaders, unless they are able to employ the stone's power.
Should we give the diamond back to the undergroundlings? Asked Tungdil.
I think so. It will save loss of life. If they really have their own rune master and an army of that size,
Whatever the Akronter might be, then Curdlegard has nothing to oppose them with.
He studied Tungdil's face.
On the contrary, if they have preserved us in the past and never tried to conquer our land despite their military superiority, it speaks in their favor. I am happy to explain this to the kings and queens.
He noted how tired-looking Tungdil's eyes had become.
Get some rest, Tungdil.
No, I can sleep on the boat over to Windsport. At last, we have all the vital people together. Now is not the time to sleep. Time is on the side of the Unslayables, not ours.
He stood up and left the room with the Magus. The village spokesman awaited them with the message that two ships of the Royal Fleet had made harbour, inquiring about a shipwrecked party. Impatiently, Tungdil woke his companions and sent them off to the ship without their breakfast. Lot Ionan summoned Durgard to his cabin, and the two Magi disappeared to talk away from prying eyes and ears. One of the ships headed off to guard the Alfar Island. A contingent of soldiers was to land and hunt down the Alf still at large. The second ship took Tungdil and his companions to Windsport Island to pick up the elf they had left at a shrine dedicated to Palandiel. They would cure his fever with Lot Ionan's magic. Now the summer showed itself from its best side. The fresh breeze filled the sails and drove the ship onwards. Tungdil had closed his eyes as soon as they cast off. He spent the crossing asleep in a hammock until Circa woke him in the evening.
"Are we there?"
He rubbed his eyes, pleased to see her. The sight of her was still unfamiliar and exciting. He was astonished that he still felt shy about responding to her advances. Belindis had agreed to set him free. Was he still bothered, perhaps, by the way he had gone about asking for his freedom? It seemed that not all the ties binding him and Belindis had really been cut. Not yet, but soon. She held out her hand to help him up. He looked at the end of the cliff where an imposing building stood. It now served less as a shrine and more as a house for Weyand's royal archives. Palandiel was no longer the favourite deity here, as she was in the realms of Ran Ribber Stur and Tabain. Ever since the enormous increase in lake size in the country, the water goddess Elria had become more popular. But innumerable records were available in the shape of parchment rolls, which held the memories of the old kingdom, its towns and villages. The ship slid past while the waves pounded against the cliff 50 paces away. Veils of spray rose up and blew over to their vessel, covering everything with a thin, damp film. Tungdil was wide awake now.
"I'll tell Lot Ionan," he said to Circa, and hurried off. It felt like running away, almost. But deep inside he was burning to know more about her and her culture, before committing himself. Too many open questions had to be answered. He knocked at the cabin door.
"We have arrived, Lot Ionan."
The Magus could read the unspoken question about how Durgard was shaping up.
"Come in," he invited, closing the door behind him.
Durgard was sitting on a bench, not looking very happy.
"My young friend here knows a few good formulae to make magic with, but he understandably lacks experience," Lot Ionan began. "I, on the other hand, have plenty of experience, but the time I spent turned to stone has left gaps in my memory."
He touched himself on the temple.
"Sometimes there's a syllable missing, or my hands make the wrong movement. That can ruin any spell."
"What does that mean for our project, Magus?"
"That Durgard and I need each other's help to confront the Unslayables. One of us without the other won't be much use."
"You are more than 100 cycles ahead of me, honored Lot Ionan," said Durgard.
"It would be strange if that were not the case, but it does not alter the fact that my tongue or my hands may let me down. I don't have the time I would need to rectify the gaps in my memory."
Lot Ionan looked at Tungdil and the axe.
"It will lie as ever in your hands to do all the fighting,"
Durgard and I will offer support, but probably no more than that.
He was about to touch Tungdil's head, but halted suddenly, caught by a flash of pain in his back.
Damned old age, he muttered. Why have I got no spells for that?
Tungdil considered the matter. Let's not tell anyone about your state of health, he suggested. The Unslayables have to believe that you two are the ones to fear. Otherwise I shan't be able to get near enough to use Keenfire. Do you agree? Lot Ionan smiled.
You are a good general, I see. We'll let friends and foe alike think that Durgard and I are the only ones up to taking on the Alpha leaders.
The ship's progress slowed. Shouts and trampling feet up on deck showed they were docking.
Now let us see about the elf, said Lot Ionan,
stepping out of the cabin in the lead. The group left the ship, passed the little town, and climbed up to the shrine, where its custodian was waiting. A man of about 60 cycles, slightly bald, and with a red nose from too much wine. His clothing was in disarray, as if flung on hastily.
Welcome back!
He bowed and led them past walls lined with bookshelves. Here were kept the ancient records of Weyand's subjects, births, marriages, and deaths. Queen Wei wanted to be able to trace the history of her land.
Your elf has not yet come round, but he still lives.
The man put on an important air.
This is due to my care, of course, as well as to his own stamina.
They stopped 3 paces short of tall double doors.
I am no medicus, but I would say that a human would have died long since.
His dull, drunkard's eyes swiveled to Lot Ionan.
Is he your medicus?
Indeed,
said the Magus, to avoid further discussion. He opened the right-hand door and went in, accompanied by Durgard, Tungdil, Ironheart, Circa, Goda, and Rodario. The rest stayed in the halls of the shrine, waiting to hear what the 2 Magi might achieve. The room was flooded with evening light and smelt of the lake and summer. Open windows let in the sound of the waves, fresh air and fine droplets of spray from the spume as the waters hit the cliffs below the building. The elf lay, eyes closed, hands on blanket and torso wrapped in bandages.
Thanks,
said Lot Ionan, closing the door firmly to leave the keeper outside.
What have you tried, Durgard? Asked the Magus.
I don't have much in the way of healing spells, he admitted ruefully.
The older Magus undid the bandage and inspected the puncture wounds in the elf's body. At the blackened edges the flesh was rotting.
You tried the formulae you found in Nudin's works?
Yes.
Tell me which ones.
Durgard reeled them off and the Magus nodded.
These are good charms. Don't reproach yourself for anything. But the elf needs different magic.
He held his hands over the wounds, his eyes hazy. He intoned a spell until a bluish glow emerged from his fingertips. The light dripped slowly like thick honey onto the damaged flesh, pooling on the elf's chest. Lot Ionan completed the charm, stepped back, and gave a sign to Durgard, who carried on the procedure. The blue turned pale yellow now. The magic caused the rotten flesh to be rejected. It shriveled up and fell off as dried skin onto the sheet. The holes left by the arrows closed up and healed over. Only lighter skin betrayed where the injuries had been.
It's finished,
breathed Durgard with relief, nodding at Lot Ionan.
Neither of us could have done this on our own, said the older of the 2, smiling. This is a good omen for our continued cooperation.
He stepped over to the bed.
Let us wake him up.
Ironheart took a bowl of water and threw it on the elf's face.
Oh, wake up there. You've been asleep long enough.
The elf jerked his eyes open. Catching sight of the grinning dwarf, he instinctively slid back, hitting his head on the bedstead. His hand flew to the side,
where he would normally have carried his weapon.
"Don't worry, friend," said Tungdil in elf language. "We found you in the groves of Alandor with 3 arrows in you. Your own people had attacked you. We brought you with us here to Weyen to look after you."
He indicated his foster father.
"This is Lot Ionan, the Forbearing, and next to him is Durgard, the Lonely. These Magi have saved your life. I am Tungdil Goldhand. Can you tell us what happened to you?"
"Tungdil Goldhand?" exclaimed the elf with relief. "Then I am in good company. I am Estelan, keeper of the Groves of Revenge."
"What's he saying?" grumbled Ironheart. "Scholar, tell him to speak so we can all understand."
"Are they all to be trusted?"
asked Estelan in his own language. He had understood the dwarf.
"Speak in Elvish for now. I'll decide later who needs to know what."
The elf began his story.
"I am Estelan, Baron of Gilsborn, and a good friend of Lutasil." He took a deep breath. "My prince is dead."
"We know. He died trying to defend the diamond, in battle with one of the monsters."
Estelan's visage darkened in fury.
"So that's the lie they're tricking you with. They're saying he fell fighting one of the Unslayable's creatures?"
He lowered his voice.
"Lutasil was murdered 4 cycles ago."
Chapter 13. Girdlegard, Queendom of Weyern, Windsport Island, late summer, 6241st solar cycle. Estelan took a deep breath. Relating the murder of his prince had obviously affected him.
"They kept it secret and gave us excuse after excuse to cover his disappearance. And by the time we learned the truth, they had moved their own people into all the positions of power. Then they took over and wiped out the last of the right-thinking elves."
Tungdil was left speechless.
"They?" he croaked. "Who are they?"
"The Eol Aetar, followers of the Eol. It's an obsessive cult. They accord the Eol a godlike status just short of Sitalia's. They had demanded Lutasil join forces with the Eol and set off to war in Girdlegard with her and her army against the creatures of Teon and Samusin. Lutasil refused and ordered them to do nothing."
"It sounds as if they did it anyway."
"Yes, they sent messengers to the Eol in secret, asking to speak with her and to find out how they could help. Nobody outside the Aetar cult knows what she told them. Ever since then, they've been trying to take over power in Alandur, to restore the elves to the pure race they once were, tolerating no evil, just like the Eol."
In Tungdil, this news broke through the last bastions of his mind like a battering ram. Sounding like an alarm in his head, it made clear the significance the new elf buildings, the shrines that he and Ironheart had seen on their recent visit. It all stemmed from the Eol's commands. Estelan lowered his gaze.
"We underestimated them. Their views took hold, and soon they had more followers than Lutasil thought good, as he told me. When he attempted to thwart them, it was too late. Like most, I did not see through their machinations until recently. After that, I listened in to several exchanges. I heard them talk about the future of the diamond. They had examined it, they said, and found it was not the genuine one."
"Examined it? How does that work?"
"I don't know. Perhaps the Eol let them into the secret of the magic. Our people are able to use simple charms, but your Magi would not call that proper magic. Maybe the Eol changed all that?"
So it wasn't a bad thing that the stone fell into the hands of the Unslayables."
Estelan shook his head.
"It never did fall into the monster's hands. They made that up to explain the death of Lutasil.
and they were planning to steal the rest of the diamonds from the fortress as soon as they had all been brought to Palland. Then they noticed me listening, and turned to get me. I escaped in spite of their arrows. He pressed Tungdil's hand. That I am still alive is thanks to you. He gave a wry smile. A dwarf. No, not thanks to me alone. The Magi have played the most important part in your recovery. But they couldn't have saved me if you hadn't taken me with you. Estelan's face grew serious. Alandor is under the sway of the Aetar. If I have understood correctly, their intention is to carry out the Eoil's plans. They want to expel evil from Girdlygard. But those few orcs and the Unslayables... You're making a mistake, Tungdil Goldhand, the elf interrupted. The Eoil gave them the order to destroy all evil, in no matter what form. The envoys, Tungdil remembered. The elves sent envoys out to the various realms, apparently to exchange knowledge. But they won't have done anything except spy on the rulers and their subjects. The selection process has begun. In the end, only a few races will survive in Girdlygard unless the Aetar are stopped. The dwarf folk have already suffered losses. The attacks on the villages and towns in Taboribor or near Borwal are down to the Aetar as well. I am sure of it. But how can they do it? They are committing evil themselves, don't they see that? Tungdil thought of the children of the smith whose wells had been poisoned. No, in their eyes it is not bad, on the contrary. When others can't understand, they take it as proof that they're doing the right thing. As long as evil is working undercover, it must be combated by those who are able to perceive it. Estelin took a deep breath. They all want the diamond, Tungdil Goldhand. The diamond is the divine power of the Eoil made manifest. Even if it hurts me to say this, and I must beg Sitalia's forgiveness, it is true. No one must trust my people any longer. Their offer of friendship is a pretense. In reality, they are planning dark deeds. Tungdil scratched his chin while his brain worked feverishly. Girdlygard was faced with its most taxing situation. The elves, undergroundlings and unslayables all claimed ownership of the diamond. For now it seemed best for the undergroundlings to have it and take it away, far from Girdlygard's borders. Are there no elves left who aren't dazzled by the propaganda? He asked Estelin. Is there no resistance movement? No, he said. I am afraid there are no clear-thinking elves any more. And, Tungdil hesitated, how many elves are there in Alandor? I don't know. I can see why you ask. If there is a war, I assume all the warriors sent out from the groves of Alandor will obey instructions and carry out the wishes of the Aetar. Tungdil knew how skilled the elvish warriors and archers were. They were far superior in battle to the humans, and even the dwarves faced an enormous challenge, getting through their deadly hail of arrows in order to engage in close combat. Perhaps the undergroundling army would be fighting not Teon's creatures, but Sitalia's, however strange the concept. Even stranger for the others. How much truth can Girdlygard tolerate? He said, more to himself than to Estelin. You should be asking how much of it they will believe, said the elf. The elves have not done anything wrong in most eyes, and have always had the reputation of being noble, the noblest race in Girdlygard. They stand for beauty, art, and goodness. His blue eyes measured Tungdil. You believe my words because you have travelled and are wise. But put yourself in the place of the kings and queens whose support we shall be needing. They have only experienced what they see as generosity from my people. They will never believe us. The Aetar will think up a story that would brand me a traitor. He gave a sigh of desperation. None of them will challenge the Aetar. Not at first,
and afterwards it will be too late.
You are right, Estelin. None of the humans will believe it.
Tungdil looked at Circa.
But the dwarves will, as soon as we've got the diamond back from the Alfar and have placed it safely away from the elves. Unless they have it, they will not dare reveal their true intentions. In the calm before the storm, we shall use your help to rouse the people of Girdlegard and warn them about the Aetar plans.
The elf nodded.
I pray that Satalia and all the ancestors may give their blessing to our endeavor. May the worst be avoided.
Estelin seemed relieved to have been able to impart this terrible knowledge to another. He let his gaze sweep the room.
Whom will you tell?
Girdlegard, northeastern part of the Brown Mountains, Forthling Kingdom, late summer, 6241st solar cycle. Tandy Burr Pitpride, of the clan of the Pitprides, raced along the long basalt planks over the series of defense ditches in front of the narrow pass into Girdlegard on the Silverfast side. Each trench was 7 paces long and 20 deep, and the sides had knife-sharp edges to slice any hapless body that fell in, sharp enough to sever chainmail links. Tandibur turned his head. Behind the trenches stood the mighty Goldfast fortress, ready to resist any invader with its unassailable gold-colored walls. The masons had built them with a finish like upended spears. Here and there jewels sparkled, giving the construction an extravagant patina. Curtain walls soared 30 paces high, and behind them the watchtower was in the form of a 50-pace tall dwarf, its forbidding head fully rotatable, turned by chains and pony power. On top of the tower's stone helmet, and in the eye, ear, and mouth cavities, guards stood watch, war machines to hand. Until now, no monster had appeared at the gates, and the catapults had never been needed. It looked as if today might be different.
"Come on! Get a move on!"
he encouraged the 50 soldiers at his back. He was bringing reinforcements for the fortifications at Silverfast. Tandibur had good reason for urgency. Silverfast was in trouble. It had been named after the silver shimmer of the stone it was built from. Gnome's silver, the dwarves called it. Attractive to look at, but worthless apart from its durability. There was a similar rationale for Goldfast's designation. The early Forthling builders had given Silverfast 5 towers pointing to the skies like the fingers of a hand, the tallest 50 paces high. From the gutter spouts, molten lead spewed onto the attackers at the gates, and their screams rose up to the battlements. A strong curtain wall connected the 5 towers, on which defenders ran about firing crossbows and throwing missiles over the parapet. The orcs had been bombarding the iron gates, battering the Forthling front line, desperate to get through. They were applying all their strength, and were repulsed neither by molten lead, arrows, or great lumps of rock. If Tandibur had not known better, he would have assumed something was hounding the green skins that scared them more than Forthling axes. He glanced up at the towers, where black smoke wafted. The burners under the smelting cauldrons were being fed constantly, but the troops would soon run out of lead.
"We'll have to use gold to pour down instead," he said quietly.
The repeated thud of a battering ram echoed back from the surrounding mountains. The metal gates screamed in protest, bending under the onslaught.
"By Vrekkus!" shouted one of Tandibor's warriors. "Just listen to that! What kind of enemy makes all that din? What foe has Teon sent?"
"You'll see them soon enough," was Tandibur's terse reply. "Whatever it is in the ravine at Silverfast, you'll need courage, a stout heart, and a sharp axe. They are the only things that can protect us from the monsters."
They saw rocks as big as a man hurled at and over the walls. In places, the heavy missiles had damaged the battlements, crushing anyone sheltering behind. In other places, smoking sacks filled with petroleum and pitch had burst against the walls, stinking terribly and making eyes and airways smart. Waves of blazing fire swallowed the dwarves on the walkways, incinerating them in seconds. And still the castle's defenders did not yield, but continued hurling stones down and setting off a hail of crossbow bolts. What the newcomers saw spurred them on to fight. Reaching the broad stairs up to the encircling walkways, Tandibur split them into two groups, right and left. Dark red dwarf blood dripped down the steps, as if to warn them not to go on. A terrible sight awaited. The walkways behind the thick fortress walls were covered in a grimly woven carpet of fast-cooling corpses. Men and women they knew well. The bodies were piled so densely that they had no option but to plant their boots on flesh rather than stone. Most had been killed by arrows. Others were victims of the missile showers from the catapults. The metallic reek of warm blood in puddles and streaming down the walls mixed with the stench of burned flesh and with the steaming vapours of the beasts besieging them. Random objects flew, smoking over their heads. Tandibur ducked automatically under his shield. Silverfast's commander had been praying for them to arrive. With two arrow wounds in his right arm already, he had now been struck on the leg with a bolt, and he could not remove it for fear of severe bleeding. He limped to a standstill some paces away, indicating a heap of stones.
"Vrakus, be thanked you have come! Take these and send them over the side!" he hurried off. "Target the team on the battering ram!"
Tandibur was motionless with shock. Then he picked up a rough boulder and heaved it onto the battlements above the gate. He looked over. Spread out on the plains in front of Silverfast, monster was jostling monster. Thousands of them, mostly orcs, surged forward, yelling and storming the gates. Further back, horrible ogres, tall as giants, and their relations, big, ugly, hairy trolls, were constantly reloading the catapults to give the defenders not a moment's respite. They were also hurling smaller missiles into the gaps in the battlements. Their aim was depressingly good. Tandibur froze. Only a few minutes before, he had encouraged a fellow dwarf to action, but his own spirit now failed him. Directly underneath, maybe 30 paces down, 100 ogres were wielding the biggest battering ram he had ever seen. Several trees must have been felled to make it, and a huge iron monster head fronted the tip. Only ogres with their titanic strength were capable of lifting the dreadful siege weapon. The gate was yielding, inch by inch, to the successive blows from the ram. The bolts and hinges were still holding, but were so badly deformed that Silverfast would soon fall. Tandibur shook off his fear and offered a prayer to Vrakus. "The fortress must not be taken." He dropped his stone over the edge and pulled his head back in to avoid enemy fire. A shrill scream next to him told him not everyone had been so lucky. He bent over the victim.
"Lie still. You'll be fine," he said,
trying to sound convincing. A missile had shattered the other's face. The dwarf could scarcely breathe and blood was bubbling out of what was left of his nose.
"We do not give up,"
croaked the dwarf, trying to grasp Tandibur's hand. But as he made the movement, his body went limp. The woven carpet of corpses had a new thread for its weft.
"Vrakus, take his soul."
Tandibur brushed aside grief. Now was no time for tears. He saw four heavy enemy rocks hit home, one after the other, in the center of the second highest tower, leaving a wide hole. Too wide. The building swayed, and great fissures appeared in the masonry. Tandibur could see the warriors at the top scampering away from the edge in panic. The top of the tower was poised over the left flank of the orc army. The tower broke in the middle. An 11th pace section crashed down onto the foe and sent rubble bouncing back up behind the lines, bombarding orcs further back. A grey dust cloud stopped Tandibor, seeing what damage the hordes had suffered. The falling tower had killed many, and Silverfast's catapults were having some success against the enemy's infantry, who were screeching in terror.
Tandibor!
Sigdal Rubinium of the Clan of the Gemstones ran over and grabbed his arm. He was a young dwarf, not even 50 cycles, and one who tended to give up rather than see things through. That was when it was a matter of gem polishing. There was blood all over his mail tunic, and he had a cut on his face which revealed white bone underneath. Where he had been standing, the battle still raged.
We have got to get back behind the ditches and retreat to Goldfast, he panted.
We have orders, replied Tandibor, not able to wrench his eyes from the smoke-shrouded fallen tower.
But it's useless, protested Sigdal,
spreading his arms wide.
Look! The missiles have crushed three of my friends, and I am drenched with their blood. It won't be long before Silverfast falls. Let's save those who still live. We can combat the next wave from the second fortress in Goldfast.
Tandibor turned to find the defender's commander. He turned just in time to see that dwarf, enveloped in a wall of fire, to fall like a burning comet from the castle walls. The next meeting of battering ram and iron gate had the stones under their feet shuddering so that wide cracks opened up. The age-old granite was starting to give way. The wind brought new low rumbles from the monsters. These deep, threatening tones reached Tandibur's ears for the first time, and no instrument he knew of could have produced them. Sigdal looked over the balustrade.
Look! They have reinforcements!
There was no holding him now.
We've got to abandon the stronghold!
Only a fool would have persisted in the face of what was so obvious.
You are right,
said Tandibor, reaching for his bugle to call the troops. Now their commander was no more. The army would follow his orders. Then came the strident screeching of orc trombones, and the merciless bombardment stopped abruptly. No more arrows or stones or firebombs hit Silverfast. All was as still as the grave.
What's going on?
Sigdal chanced a quick glance into the distance.
A trick?
It sounds as if they're turning the catapults round,
Tandibor interrupted, coming to stand next to him, his shield held high as protection from stray arrows. On the other side of the plain, a broad black front was rolling nearer. Compared to the numbers of monsters round Silverfast, this was not a whole army of fresh replacement troops. Tandibor calculated it must be about 2,000, but each armor-suited warrior was double the height of a dwarf.
What are they?
Asked Sigdal, fascinated.
See how they run? Prive fracas! It looks like they've got bodies of iron, but they're running like ponies.
Meanwhile, some of the catapults had been rotated. Frantic ogres and trolls were loading and firing at the advancing troops, but the missiles did no damage at all, hitting the ground harmlessly behind them. They were travelling too fast for the artillery to reload and adjust the trajectory. The threatening metallic sound of crashing armor plating got louder. The monsters were still staring in disbelief at the approaching foe. Then the front line started to shriek, and one of the orcs pushed back through the throng in the direction of Silverfast, where it tried to scale the walls using fingers and toes. This was the sign the hordes had waited for. Their paralysis was over. Grunting and screeching, the orcs renewed their onslaught on the stronghold, throwing up siege ladders, but now total confusion reigned. They hurled away whatever they carried, weapons or armor. Some broke their sword blades off to help them clamber up the sheer sides of the fortress. If their progress was impeded,
orcs wrenched slower colleagues off the walls. Two ogres made a run for it, trampling a band of orcs. They tried to scramble up the rungs of a ladder far too frail to carry their weight, and the wood shattered, sending them plunging back down to lie motionless at